I've decided I don't want to know why you want to see him, and I don't want to know what happens afterward, if anything. But I do want to say thanks for everything you've already done. Your audit will help us, and I think you probably saved us in Bismarck, and your hearts have been in the right place throughout, and I'm very grateful for all of that. Nobody spoke. I'm going to retire, Stuyvesant said. I'd have to fight to save my career now, and the truth is, I don't like my career enough to fight for it. These guys were never your agents, Reacher said. I know that, but I lost two people. Therefore, my career is over. But that's my decision and my problem. All I mean to say to you is I'm glad I got the chance to meet Joe's brother, and it was a real pleasure working with you both. Nobody spoke. And I'm glad you were there at the end for M.E. Reacher looked away. Stuyvesant took the envelopes out of his pocket again. I don't know whether to hope you're right or wrong, he said. About Wyoming, I mean. We'll have three agents and some local cops. That's not a lot of cover if things turn out bad. He passed the envelopes across the desk. There's a car waiting downstairs. You get a one-way ride to Georgetown, and then you're on your own. They went down in the elevator, and Reacher detoured into the main hall. It was vast and dark and gray and deserted, and the cold marble echoed with his footsteps. He stopped underneath the carved panel and glanced up at his brother's name, glanced at the empty space where Frohlich's would soon be added. Then he glanced away and walked back and joined Nagley. They pushed through the small door with the wired glass porthole and found their car. The white tent was still in place across the sidewalk in front of Armstrong's house. The driver pulled up with the rear door tight against the contour and spoke into his wrist microphone. A second later, Armstrong's front door opened and three agents stepped out. One walked forward through the canvas tunnel and opened the car door. Reacher got out and Nagley slid out beside him. The agent closed the door again and stood impassive on the curb, and the car drove away. The second agent held his arms out in a brief mime that they should stand still and be searched. They waited in the whitened canvas gloom. Nagley tensed while strange hands patted her down, but it was superficial. They barely touched her, and they missed Reacher's ceramic knife. It was hidden in his sock. The agents led them inside to Armstrong's hallway and closed the door. The house was larger than it appeared from the outside. It was a big, substantial place that looked like it had been standing for 100 years and was good for maybe 100 more. The hallway had dark antiques and striped paper on the walls and a clutter of framed pictures everywhere. There were rugs on the floors laid over thick wall-to-wall carpeting. There was a battered garment bag resting in a corner, presumably ready for the emergency trip to Oregon. "This way," one of the agents said. He led them deep into the house and threw a dog leg in the hallway to a huge eat-in kitchen that would have looked at home in a log cabin. It was all pine, with a big table at one end and all the cooking equipment at the other. There was a strong smell of coffee. Armstrong and his wife were sitting at the table with heavy china mugs and four different newspapers. Mrs. Armstrong was wearing a jogging suit and a sheen of sweat, like there might be a home gym in the basement. It looked like she wasn't going to Oregon with her husband. She had no makeup on. She looked a little tired and dispirited, like the events of Thanksgiving Day had altered her feelings in a fundamental way. Armstrong himself looked composed. He was wearing a clean shirt under a jacket with the sleeves pulled up over his forearms. No tie. He was reading the editorials from the New York Times and the Washington Post, side by side.
"Coffee?"
Mrs. Armstrong asked. Reacher nodded, and she stood up and walked into the kitchen area and pulled two more mugs off hooks and filled them. Walked back with one in each hand. Reacher couldn't decide if she was short or tall. She was one of those women who looked short in flat shoes and tall in heels. She handed the mugs over without much expression. Armstrong looked up from his papers.
"I'm sorry to hear about your mother," Nagley said.
Armstrong nodded. "Mr. Stuyvesant told me you want a private conversation," he said.
"Private would be good," Reacher said.
"Should my wife join us?"
"That depends on your definition of privacy."
Mrs. Armstrong glanced at her husband.
"You can tell me afterward," she said, "before you leave, if you need to."
Armstrong nodded again and made a show of folding his newspapers. Then he stood up and detoured to the coffee machine and refilled his mug. "Let's go," he said. He led them back to the dog-legged hallway and into a side room. Two agents followed and stood on each side of the door on the outside. Armstrong glanced out at them as if in apology and shut the door on them, walked around and stood behind a desk. The room was set up like a study, but it was more recreational than for real. There was no computer. The desk was a big old item made from dark wood. There were leather chairs and books chosen for the look of their spines. There was paneling and an old Persian rug. There was an air freshener somewhere putting fragrance into the hush. There was a framed photograph on the wall. It showed a person of indeterminate gender standing on an ice floe. He or she was wearing an enormous padded down coat with a hood and thick mittens that reached the elbow. The hood had a big fur ruff that framed the face tight. The face itself was entirely hidden by a ski mask and smoked yellow snow goggles. One of the elbow-high mittens was raised in greeting. "Our daughter," Armstrong said. "We asked her for a photo because we miss her. That's what she sent. She has a sense of humor." He sat down behind the desk. Reacher and Nagley took a chair each. "This all feels very confidential," Armstrong said. Reacher nodded. "And in the end, I think we'll all agree it should be kept confidential." "What's on your mind?" "Mr. Stuyvesant gave us some ground rules," Reacher said. "I'm going to start breaking them right now." "The Secret Service intercepted 6 threatening messages against you. The first came in the mail 18 days ago. 2 more came in the mail subsequently, and 3 were hand-delivered." Armstrong said nothing. "You don't seem surprised." Armstrong shrugged. "Politics is a surprising business." "I guess it is," Reacher said. "All 6 messages were signed with a thumbprint. We traced the print to an old guy in California. His thumb had been amputated and stolen and used like a rubber stamp." Armstrong said nothing. "The second message showed up in Stuyvesant's own office. Eventually, it was proved that a surveillance technician named Nendick had placed it there. Nendick's wife had been kidnapped in order to coerce his actions. He was so frightened of the danger to her posed by his inevitable interrogation that he went into some kind of a coma. But we're guessing she was already dead by then, anyway." Armstrong was silent. "There's a researcher in the office called Swain who made an important mental connection. He felt we were miscounting. He realized that Nendick was supposed to be a message in himself, thereby making 7 messages, not 6. Then we added the guy in California who had had his thumb removed and made it 8 messages. Plus, there were 2 homicides on Tuesday which made the 9th and 10th messages, one in Minnesota and one in Colorado. 2 unrelated strangers named Armstrong were killed as a kind of demonstration against you."
"Oh, no," Armstrong said.
"So, 10 messages," Reacher said. "All of them designed to torment you, except you hadn't been told about any of them. But then I started wondering whether we're still miscounting. And you know what? I'm pretty sure we are. I think there were at least 11 messages." Silence in the small room.
"What would be the 11th? Armstrong asked.
"Something that slipped through," Reacher said. "Something that came in the mail, addressed to you, something that the Secret Service didn't see as a threat. Something that meant nothing at all to them, but something that meant a lot to you."
Armstrong said nothing.
"I think it came first," Reacher said. "Right at the very beginning, maybe, before the Secret Service even caught on. I think it was like an announcement that only you would understand. So I think you've known about this all along. I think you know who's doing it, and I think you know why."
"People have died," Armstrong said. "That's a hell of an accusation."
"Do you deny it?" Armstrong said nothing. Reacher leaned forward. "Some crucial words were never spoken," he said. "Thing is, if I was standing there serving turkey, and then somebody started shooting, and somebody else was suddenly bleeding to death on top of me, sooner or later I'd be asking, who the hell were they? What the hell did they want? Why the hell were they doing that? Those are fairly basic questions. I'd be asking them loud and clear, believe me. But you didn't ask them. We saw you twice afterward, in the White House basement and then later at the office. You said all kinds of things. You asked, had they been captured yet? That was your big concern. You never asked who they might be or what their possible motive was. And why didn't you ask? Only one possible explanation. You already knew." Armstrong said nothing. I think your wife knows, too, Reacher said. You conveyed her anger at you for putting people at risk. I don't think she was generalizing. I think she knows you know, and she thinks you should have told somebody. Armstrong was silent. So I think you're feeling a little guilty now, Reacher said. I think that's why you agreed to make the television statement for me, and that's why you suddenly want to go to the service itself, some kind of a conscience thing, because you knew, and you didn't tell anybody. I'm a politician, Armstrong said. We have hundreds of enemies. There was no point in speculating. Bullshit, Reacher said. This isn't political, this is personal. Your kind of political enemy is some North Dakota soybean grower you made 10 cents a week poorer by altering a subsidy, or some pompous old senator you declined to vote with. The soybean grower might make a half-hearted effort against you at election time, and the senator might bide his time and screw you on some big floor issue, but neither one of them is going to do what these guys are doing. Armstrong said nothing. I'm not a fool, Reacher said. I'm an angry man who watched a woman I was fond of bleed to death. I'm not a fool either, Armstrong said. I think you are. Something's coming back at you from the past, and you think you can just ignore it and hope for the best? Didn't you realize it would happen? You people have no perspective. You thought you were world famous already just because you were in the House and the Senate where you weren't. Real people never heard of you until the campaign this summer. You thought all your little secrets were already out? Well, they weren't either. Armstrong said nothing. Who are they? Reacher asked. Armstrong shrugged. Your guess? Reacher paused a beat. I think you've got a temper problem. Same as your dad. I think way back before you learned to control it, you made people suffer, and some of them forgot about it, but some of them didn't. I think it's a part of some particular person's life that somebody once did something bad to them. Maybe hurt them, or hurt their self-esteem, or screwed them up in some other kind of a big way. I think that particular person repressed it deep down inside until they turned on the TV one day and saw your face for the first time in 30 years. Armstrong sat still for a long moment. How far along is the FBI with this? They're nowhere. They're out beating the bushes for people that don't exist. We're way ahead of them. And what are your intentions? I'm going to help you, Reacher said. Not that you deserve it in any way at all. It'll be a purely accidental byproduct of me standing up for Nendick and his wife, and an old guy called Andretti, and two people called Armstrong and Crosetti, and especially for Froelich, who was my brother's friend. There was silence. Will this stay confidential? Armstrong asked. Reacher nodded. It'll have to, purely for my sake. Sounds like you're contemplating a very serious course of action. People play with fire, they get burned. That's the law of the jungle. Where the hell else do you think you live? Armstrong was quiet another long moment. So then you'll know my secret and I'll know yours. Reacher nodded. And we'll all live happily ever after. There was another long silence. It lasted a whole minute. Reacher saw Armstrong the politician fade away, and Armstrong the man replace him. You're wrong in most ways, but not all of them. He leaned down and opened a drawer, took out a padded mailer and tossed it on the desk. It skidded on the shiny wood and came to rest an inch from the edge. I guess this counts as the first message. It arrived on election day. I suppose the Secret Service must have been a little puzzled, but they didn't see anything really wrong with it, so they passed it right along. The mailer was a standard commercial stationery product. It was addressed to Brooke Armstrong, United States Senate, Washington, D.C. The address was printed on a familiar self-adhesive label in the familiar computer font, Times New Roman, 14-point, bold. It had been mailed somewhere in the state of Utah on October 28th. The flap had been opened a couple of times and resealed. Reacher eased it back and looked inside, held it so Nagley could see.